Episode 9. The third hidden lesson of school. The installation of indifference. Critical thinking question. What happened to why?
I've got a right to be wrong. My mistakes will make me strong. I'm stepping out into the great unknown.
Welcome to Episode 9 of School Sucks Podcast, the third hidden lesson of school, the installation of indifference. Now, hopefully, by this point in the show, we've been able to establish how and why public education trains young people to be obedient and to conform. But what if this doesn't work for some people? Like, what if some young students don't properly absorb the obedience training, or the message that they're supposed to fit in and be like everybody else, to not rock the boat? Or what if later in life they somehow break out of this obedience and conformity training? They start to develop ideas that are disobedient to authority and nonconformist. Certainly, the same kinds of people who would want to train children to be obedient and predictable would also probably want to have, I don't know, some kind of safety net in case that training failed, or in case students were able to free themselves from that training as adults. And that brings us to this third lesson that I call the installation of indifference. Now, in the first two lessons that I discussed, it's very difficult to isolate public education as the sole delivery method for obedience and conformity. Certainly, young people can pick up this kind of training from family or social pressures, the pressure to obey parents, the pressure to conform to a group. So public education might not be the only culprit in people being obedient and conformist. But indifference and apathy is an extremely unnatural condition for a human being. And all of us who've spent any amount of time around young children, whether they've learned how to talk or not, we see the natural condition. We see the curiosity. We hear that same question over and over and over again. Why? 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 So what happened to why?
Well, I think by now you know where I'm going with this. Public school is what happened. See, I believe that every time a child opens their eyes and points them in a certain direction, they could have, I don't know, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 questions about what they see. But public education, this 12-year process of being force-fed information by people who present themselves either intentionally or inadvertently as having all of the answers already, that encourages the child to have zero questions. about what they see. School is a blindfold for those open eyes. There was an educational theorist named Paul Fieri who once made the statement that public education castrates curiosity. Now, while that's certainly vivid, I think it's a little bit of an overstatement. If you've ever been castrated, or you know somebody who has, either accidentally or for religious reasons, it's safe to say that there's something that's gone that is not coming back. And I don't really feel like that's the case with curiosity. I feel like during those 12 years, it is just drowned out by routines. Like I said, this force-feeding of information where the questions are sort of controlled. And because of that, the curiosity and the creativity of the individual is replaced with indifference and apathy. Throughout the entire process of public education, all of the motivators for learning are purely extrinsic. It starts with cookies and stickers, and then it's about good grades and please parents and satisfied teachers and award ceremonies and scholarships and college admissions. But at no point that I can really think of is there anything powerful and intrinsic behind what the child is learning. I think it was Jonathan Taylor Gatto who pointed out in a speech once that between school and television, which is just a pretty much a continuous bombardment of intellectual insults, children are left with virtually no time to actually grow up in. If you think about how much time and energy school takes during the week, it's really a tremendous drain on a young person. And any free time that young people have is really used as a retreat from anything that is actually academic or educational. They're taught that school is the most important thing. I talk to parents all the time who say that they're going to cut out sports or extracurricular activities so their child can get better grades. And this is so common that we're going to take away the things that you're good at and the things that you love because you're not doing good at the things that you hate. Kind of a bizarre parenting strategy, but it's very, very common. And because of all of this, children learn to associate education with pain and boredom through public education, and that's why it continues on past the 12-year process. And I think if you look at what's going on in America right now, there's these little children, babies, infants, little people who haven't even learned to talk yet, much less defend themselves, who are being sold into tax slavery, who are being forced to inherit huge, huge debts from what's going on in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and a variety of new types of social programs that are coming very, very soon. The parents of these children are not only doing nothing to fight against this or stop this, they're actually encouraging it through a shameful passivity that they've been dragooned into believing is an obligation or a duty. Every Monday and Tuesday, they turn over the entire product of their labor to the people who are saddling their children with these debts. And most of them, every November, are going to check boxes next to the names of these thieves and strangers, just for a little extra encouragement of what they're doing. And we've all been well trained to be indifferent to that process of what goes on. We're told that watching these people write their opinions down on paper, the lawmaking process, is like watching sausages be made. It's not something that you want to do. But when the sausages are being made out of the ground-up future prosperity of your children, it's probably worth trying to break out of that apathy and indifference and take a closer look at what's going on. And then to ask yourself, what could I be doing to stop this? It's a question that we're trained not to ask, but in the event that we do ask it, we're also trained to answer it with one word. Nothing. What could I do? I'm just one person. And so it's back to sleep. That is indifference. That is apathy. That is something that is learned in public education. Oh, and while all this is going on, while your children are being sold into slavery, whether they're your children or your siblings or your nephews and nieces are being sold into slavery, thousands of completely innocent and nonviolent strangers are also being murdered by the activities of these same types of people. Just wanted to throw that in there at the end. It's really a larger topic for another time, but that's going on too. Oh, and just one more thing. These children of ours, these sons and daughters and nieces and nephews and siblings who are about to be born, our newborns, our infants, our toddlers, these defenseless little souls who will be forced to inherit the burden and the debt of all the things that most people are completely indifferent to right now. These little people will soon enter the same process that all of us did. And just 12 short years later, their curiosity and creativity and myriad of how and why questions will be completely smothered out with the same type of indifference that's all too familiar to most of us. And they'll passively watch the same thing, the same predation, happen to the next generation. Unless, of course, something changes. Like the end of public education. We learn because we are curious. We learn because we ask questions. But public education is not about questions, it's about answers, and usually pretty crappy ones. Now don't get me wrong, students are encouraged to ask questions about the Pythagorean theorem, and the difference between meiosis and mitosis, and about misplaced modifiers. And of course then there's the most important question of all in school. Do I need to know this for the test? The questions that are actually important are never asked. What the hell am I doing here? Why does this take so long? Why am I being forced to do things that I'm absolutely not interested in at all and I know that I will never use in my life? Those questions are forbidden. But those are the real questions. And there's simply no time for such inquiries. The entire assembly line can't come to a halt, so one assembly line worker can question why the assembly line is there and why they work on it. John Dewey warned about these kinds of people who think for themselves because they threaten to spoil the harmony of the collectivistic society that he and other educationists envisioned. And, you know, maybe John Dewey wasn't necessarily an evil guy. Maybe he just had this vision for this happy socialist utopia that he wanted to use the public education system in America to build. So maybe he was just totally misguided. But far, far, far more dangerous people have realized that when you have a system that does pretty much what Dewey wanted it to do, to stamp out individualism, to discourage questions and curiosity, it provides a foundation that you can build anything you want on top of. And I think the last 10 years have provided an excellent and horrifying illustration of that.
You say, what about that?
Well, let's use some statistics to try to bring this home, because the statistics are just appalling. On the eve of the invasion of Iraq, 60% of Americans were convinced that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11. And 80% of those who were in favor of the war cited this bit of misinformation as one of the chief reasons why they favored an invasion. So how can you have a democracy when on an issue as important as 9/11 and Iraq, And 9/11, you know, probably the most important event in the last half century since the Kennedy assassination, and we can't get this basic fact right about it. How can you have a democracy that way?
So are you saying that in a democracy, when the people aren't informed, and this is almost one of those questions that says that my kids would say duh about, if the people aren't informed, if the people aren't paying attention, then they're easy to hoodwink.
Exactly. People are sitting ducks for wily and manipulative politicians if they don't know enough. Thomas Jefferson, 2 centuries ago, said that if you expect to have freedom and ignorance, you expect something that never was and never will be. And yet I've had a lot of resistance from people saying, oh, you know, the American people, they know enough, they get enough, they follow the news enough, well, but they actually don't.
Rick, let me put you on the spot. Has this administration, the Bush administration, done that or taken advantage of that more than other administrations?
This is not a Republican problem. This is not a Democratic Party problem. This is an American problem. I can go back to Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat in the Vietnam War. He was pulling some of the same shenanigans as the Bush administration did now. When people have power and they see that they can wink, wink, get by with a dropped hint here or some misinformation there, they do it. Just the other day, on the front page of the New York Times was a story about John McCain and what was...
Now, I know that that's not like the most root-striking clip about this issue, but it's probably the best, or at least one of the best, that the mainstream media has to offer. After all, most people at MSNBC and CNN and Fox News and the New York Times really don't mind people being impressionable and misinformed. They're kind of banking on that. So at this point, I think it's pretty clear that I'm positioning our natural curiosity as sort of the opposite of indifference and apathy, two things which lead to people being easily misled and, in most cases, just being completely ignorant about what's happening around them. In Teenage Liberation Handbook, How to Quit School and Get a Real Life and Education, Grace Llewellyn explains this quite well. In the second chapter of the book, which is titled School is Not for Learning, there's a section called Love of Learning. And Grace writes, "If you had always been free to learn, you would follow your natural tendency to find out as fully as possible about the things that interest you, cars or stars. We are all born with what they call love of learning, but it dives off into an elusive void when we go to school. After all, school does not help you focus on what you love because it insists that you devote equal time to 6 or so, quote, subjects. While interviewing an unschooled actress, editor Suzanne Scheffer made an astute observation. Quote, it's funny that people think kids should be well-rounded but don't seem to have the same expectations of adults. Adults seem to realize you can't do everything, unquote. In Walden, Thoreau laments, quote, our lives are frittered away by detail. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. I say let your affairs be as 2 or 3, and not 100 or 1,000, unquote. Of course, quitting school doesn't guarantee that you're going to learn more in every subject than you did in school. If you hate math in school and decide to continue studying it outside of school, it's possible that you won't enjoy it any more or learn it much better, although being able to work without ridicule and at your own speed will help. You will see a dramatically wonderful change in the way you learn about the things that interest you. What's more, you will find that you are interested in things that haven't yet caught your attention, and that you can love at least some of the things which repulsed you in school. Beyond the love and pursuit of something specific, there's another quality you might also call love of learning. It's simple curiosity, which kills more tired assumptions than cats. Some people move around with their ears and eyes perked open like raccoons, ready to find out something new and like it. Do everything you can to cultivate this characteristic, and it will eventually enliven your life immeasurably. However, curiosity is another stubborn quality that thrives on freedom. Therefore, school squishes it. Curiosity is an active habit, and it needs the freedom to explore and move around and get your hands into lots of pots. It needs the freedom to watch TV with the remote control and flip through the channels at will. It needs the freedom to thumb through science news and stop only where you want to. It needs the freedom to browse through your library's whole shelf of poetry. It needs the freedom to visit a museum solo, spending an hour with the Birds of Prey exhibit and walking right past the collection of 17th century embroideries, or vice versa. Curiosity puts itself on hold when it isn't allowed to move at its own pace. I am thinking of the week-long field trip our middle school took to Washington, D.C., and how my own curiosity took a nap during most of our guided tours. Even at the fun places like Williamsburg and Jamestown, and how I raced around excitedly when we had an unleashed day at the Smithsonian. On the upside, the ironic truth is that everyone loves to learn, or at least did as a baby, and can get to be that way again. As John Holt points out, children do not need to be made to learn about the world or shown how. They want to, and they know how. In fact, it could all add up to a great opening line the night you decide to break the news to your parents. Mom, Dad, I'd really like to quit school because I'd rather learn. So that's the end of the passage. Now, I've gotten a few emails from students, people who are actually still in school, who have asked me, okay, I've realized these things. What should I do now? And I really don't feel all too comfortable making suggestions about such important decisions to people that I don't even know. But one thing that I would recommend is going and getting a copy of this book, Teenage Liberation Handbook by Grace Llewellyn, and reading it. And I think you'll have a much easier time making an informed decision for yourself about what you should do next. Leaving school, surprisingly, I mean, even if you look at the history of public education and the statistics of how the schools perform as far as providing actual education is concerned, the leaving public education, leaving public school, is still considered a very taboo subject. Even the language that's used to talk about leaving school, to talk about freeing yourself from public education, has such a negative connotation, right? Dropping out doesn't sound good. But in closing today, I thought I would counter that with a quote from John Holt. Holt was a teacher and also the educational theorist behind the idea of unschooling, which we'll be talking about a lot more in the future. I always think about how school is considered to be so essential for learning. And Holt once said, "The most important thing any teacher has to learn, not to be learned in any school of education I have ever heard of, can be expressed in 7 words. Learning is not the product of teaching. Learning is the product of the activity of learners." Now, I would say that school is completely unnecessary. Any kind of formal schooling is completely unnecessary for real learning. And in most cases, for most people, for something like 90% of people in the United States anyway, public education is a liability. It stops real learning because it interferes so much with our natural curiosity and installs on top of it this apathy and indifference. And I would agree with Holt, real learning has nothing to do with teaching, with making a young person feign interest in something while forcing them to do a task related to that thing. Learning comes from curiosity. And when curiosity is crippled like this, and indifference takes its place, real learning is not happening. What goes on in public schools is memorization and imitation. It's basically glorified dog training with Jim. And this is just so, so tragic to me that this is still going on in the 21st century. This encouragement of apathy and this suffocation of curiosity. Because the whole world is right there for young people. The whole world is right there. And it's pretty much all for free. I think about the time in which my opinions about the world, about philosophy, about politics and ethics were formed, the amount of information that I had access to. And then I think about my parents' generation. My parents' generation is late 50s, early 60s now. when their opinions were being formed about the world that they lived in. They had three network television stations regulated by the FCC, a couple of newspapers maybe, and public school and Life magazine. So think about what will exist for this generation that's going through school right now. And I think you can see the tragedy if they're just grinded through this machine to be these non-curious sponges for the dissemination of top-down information. The dictator Joseph Stalin once said that education is a weapon whose effects depend on who holds it in his hands and at who it is aimed. Stalin, incidentally, I think the conditions are such in this country that if he was alive today, he could probably be elected president of the United States. And you think about everything that's happened militarily in the last 10 years, Guantanamo Bay, rendition, the slow creep towards this socialist totalitarianism, he'd probably make a pretty good candidate. His campaign manager would probably want to take him out of that military uniform and shave off that mustache. But the basic criteria for an American president is there, as far as what dumbed down and apathetic people want from a leader. Good public speaker and good hairdo. And even if he just came back to life in the next 10 years, after everything that he did, he'd still probably fare okay. Because what I've realized is that most young voters don't even know who he is. And you know what? Even if they did know the history of Soviet Russia and they did know the atrocities of Joseph Stalin, he could just give a speech filled with rhetoric and demagoguery, convincing them all that it was completely necessary for the common good. Throw that in there at the end. But Stalin said, once again, education is a weapon whose effects depend on who holds it in his hands and at whom it is aimed. Well, if we look at history, Stalin's intentions were clear. And throughout almost all of history, education has been in the hands of violent and dangerous and powerful people. But in the 21st century, education is now in the hands of nonviolent people, of us. So maybe it's not a weapon anymore. Maybe it's now a tool. And it brings up the interesting question, what can we do with it once we stop? And I don't mean we, I mean, you know, most people. Stop being indifferent and apathetic. Thank you for listening. Take care.
Got a right to be wrong. My mistakes will make me strong. I'm stepping out into the great unknown. I'm feeling wings, though I've never flown. I got a mind. And blood to the bone. See, I'm not made of stone. Got a right to be wrong. So just leave me alone. Leave me alone.